Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio. Hi, and welcome to the show. Today is Monday, September 27th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Dr. Tim's not with us today, so he asked me to play the interview that he did with Mira Rubin. It's only 40 minutes long, so we will begin the second hour after this interview is over. So enjoy listening to the interview that Tim did with Mira Rubin. Thank you. I'll be back.
Well, Mira, thank you so much for joining us here today. It's a pleasure to see you again.
I am so delighted to be here with you, Tim. Thank you.
I was hoping you could start us off by letting us know a little bit about how you got into the work you do and what drives your passion for it.
I think the reason or the driving force for getting me into the work that I do is that I was searching for a way to fix myself. I felt very broken for most of my life, really. And so I was always seeking modalities, techniques, answers, solutions. And years ago, when I was about 30, well, I had prior experiences, but when I was about 30, I took training in hypnosis and neurolinguistic programming and something else called One Brain, which introduced me to emotional intelligence and muscle testing. And I've been working with that for years. Since I was a teenager, consciousness has been my most compelling curiosity. And so all of that combined, I think, it really compelled my interest and a desire to find a way out of the pain that I had been experiencing for most of my life, pain and depression, emotional pain.
And so how long have you been doing the work in the format that it's currently in?
That's hard to say because it really has been an evolution. And the work has educated me, but I would say probably easily more than 5 years, but it's been more than a 30-year process.
What's the typical clientele that you work with?
So my work is really not for people who are new to transformation. It's not for people who haven't done a lot of work already. So on the other side of that, who it is for is people who are schooled in emotional intelligence, who have typically the teachers, the healers, the therapists, the transformational people that have already had enough foundation to be accepting their responsibility for their lives, the quality of their lives. To recognize that they have the ability to shift and change things. They've moved out of victimhood into creatorship in one way or another. So those are the folks that I work with.
And I'm assuming that doesn't necessarily mean people have to be a certain age.
Not at all. Not at all. I've worked with people of all ages, from, I guess, the youngest person I worked with was maybe 10, I work with people in their 70s, you know, all the way through 20s, 30s, 40s, the whole gamut.
So how do you introduce the type of work you do or the process you do when you're talking to someone?
So it's such a great question, because the work that I do is indescribable, really, in terms of the results. I mean, I explain it as an evolution of NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming, and hypnosis, and I speak of it kind of as shamanic work, because it engages people on an other than conscious level. So it's sort of dream time kind of stuff too. Because the language is so inadequate to describe the experience that people have of radical transformation, the way that I introduce people to the work is by giving a session. So the reason for that is I've worked with people that in the beginning of a session were filled with self-hatred that they'd had throughout their lives. And at the end of a session, that self-hatred is gone. And I could tell you that, and I could tell you I've worked with people that felt suicidal and not had acted on it, but were thinking of dying a lot and having that shift. But it doesn't, as radical as that might be for the person who experiences it, my recounting of it doesn't carry the impact that experience has when it is a personal experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is that my experience of your work, because we did a session a couple days ago, was that it's just a process. It's not really a technique.
I don't know the distinction. What's the distinction?
Well, it's like, you know, I don't have to follow a format or a formula. I don't have to have a device that I learn to operate. I don't, you know, and this kind of leads into my next question for you, which is, how do you conceptualize, how do you think about what that transformational process is? What drives that? How do people get the results they get when they do the work with you?
I think anything we don't have an adequate explanation for looks like magic, right? So I think the way that I conceptualize it, and it may or may not be true, is that the reason the process works so powerfully is because it is largely driven by my clients' other than conscious intelligence. And for, I believe, and it may or may not be true, but I believe that our other than conscious intelligence, and I say that rather than unconscious, because unconscious means, you know, it has its own implications, has all the answers that we need. And one of the things that is very prevalent or foundational to this work, so it's not a technique, but there are certain guideposts to the way that I do the work. And one of the things is non-judgment. So the way that the work is done allows us to be present to what's going on for us without judging. And I think that one of the greatest impediments to transformation in therapeutic context is a lot of self-judgment, a lot of self-analysis, a lot of cogitation that creates a resistance to just allowing what's there. So that's the foundational principle of the work, is to be present to what's there, allowing what's there, whatever it is. And then also there's a somatic component. So there's a, what does it feel like in your body? What's the emotion attendant to it? What's the visual or the conceptual piece? And bouncing back and forth between these different elements and noticing what shifts just by allowing ourselves to be present to the experience.
it's like going on the internal safari with a guide who's never been there before, but she knows not to panic.
Thank you for that. Well, speaking of knowing not to panic, I can say that I have been in sessions with, you never know where the session's going to go. And I've been in sessions with people that have had extremely intense emotional experiences on the way. And I think that one thing that I spoke earlier of, the pain that I had experienced, emotional pain in my life, I think that that has served me to allow me to be present with somebody in that moment of fear or panic or profound grief or whatever, and to allow that that is just a moment and it is in a process of moving through. There have been one or two times that I got a little nervous about whether we were going to get to the other side of it or not, I have to say. But it's powerful, and some people experience intense emotion during the process and other people not at all, and other people go through it joyfully and still get the transformation. So
that's one of the things about when I'm working with people, and people say, well, how do you work with trauma? What's the best way to work with depression, or the best way to work with, you know, name a label.
Right.
And my usual comeback is the best way is to remember you're not working with that. You're working with a person.
100%.
That was my experience of doing the work with you, is that it's very much just this walk into whatever's there. And you've already mentioned the idea of observation on the multiple levels, and acceptance. And for a lot of people, that's a foreign concept, especially in some of the therapeutic modalities that have developed. Trying to fix, identifying something as a problem and trying to fix it was one of our big pushes for a long time in the psychotherapeutic realm. And so many people have found that has limitations, right? That labeling and then the cognitive structure around that, I can make some adjustments within that cognitive structure, but I don't realize what I'm missing outside of it and the vast resources that each person has. And that's the kind of thing I believe you help people tap into.
Thank you for that. Yes, I think the thing that distinguishes my work from NLP or hypnosis or so many other modalities is that those are driven by the agenda of the practitioner. And in this case, I don't have an agenda. My agenda, if anything, is to be fully present to the journey that the other person is going on. And I realized that I didn't really create a context for folks to understand what this process looks like. So I just want to lay the foundation so, you know, people maybe can follow along with us a little better. So what I do in this session is I just start out by saying, okay, what is it we're going to work on? And my initial question is, what in your way of being, if it were to change, would be life altering? And so answers to that question vary from, I wouldn't have fear, or I would feel better about myself, or I wouldn't feel like a loser, or who knows, you know, those kinds of things. And then once we establish what we're working on or the arena that we're in, I'll say, okay, so what I set certain coordinates. This is the woo-woo piece of what I do in time and space or dimension or whatever. And I do that through muscle testing. And then, and that's usually invisible to my client, but I think it is actually a really important factor to the work. And the effectiveness of it, frankly. But anyway, then I'll say, okay, so what's the first thing that comes to mind? And I literally have done a session, as I told you, on popcorn and cotton candy, because that's the symbol that came up for this person, and we interacted with it, and they had a remarkable result. I've had other clients where they had all these horribly bloody visuals, and then there would be a result. I've had other people that have had just joyful travels through the woods and into the stars. And, you know, so the reason that it's so powerful is that whatever those symbols are, arise from the consciousness of the person that I'm working with. And so their inner map, so to speak, is making itself present in a way that doesn't have to make any sense at all, but that is untying all the strings and wires that are keeping things bundled up the way that they were and allowing for a change in experience and conceptualization.
And when you say experience, my mind goes immediately to the physical as well as the emotional and the mental. And that's one of the things that, you know, if people ask me, what do you wish they would teach in therapy schools that they never taught you? And that would be it, that there is no separation between the physical and the mental and the emotional. It's just an energy system, and it's all connected in ways that we are not, we're literally trained to believe the opposite of that, that this is discreetly over here in one bucket and this is over there in another bucket. And so, and when you ask the question of me in the session, I make an answer, but then when you say, so what do you notice when that happens, I start to feel physical sensations. There were just two broken bones in my past that came up in the session. I started to feel energy around where that injury was. And these, you know, these injuries are 45 years ago or more. And so the value of being able to have someone like you guide a person into and through that connection without the judgment or without the labeling was really powerful.
Thank you. Thank you. And I want to point out that the fact that you had the experience of two instances of broken bones, that was the first time in my experience of over 1,000 sessions where someone had broken bone memories. And I would venture to say that it was no accident that they came up. They were relevant to the topic that we were addressing somehow, those instances. So people have all kinds of physical experiences, maybe just a crick in the neck that shows up, or energy in the belly, or where do you feel that behind my eyes, for example. You know, so I think that one of the pieces of this magic is creating that somatic experience, creating the integration of mind, body, energy, emotion, that it is, we are an energetic system. And as you said, you hit all my buzzwords. And as an energetic system, emotion is energy. And if it is ignored long enough, it will manifest physically in some way, shape, or form. Plus, when we have physical experiences, like physical traumas, like a bone break or whatever, then there are emotions become part of that physical manifestation as well. So it can last, it can stay for 40 some years, right? It's like our bodies are this remarkable repository of information and energy. And that's why it's so important to be able to move emotional energy through. You know, one of my experiences, and maybe I'll get, I hope I don't get, hate mail or something as a result of this, but one of the things that I've noticed over years and years is a high correlation between cancer and anger. And I don't know if you've noticed that in your work with people, but I've noticed that there's like unresolved rage. And if you think about it, anger consumes us, right? And so, you know, it's interesting to be recognizing that it is all of one, that it is all one system. And the reductionist idea of looking at the body as a machine, and that if this part doesn't work, if we just fix this part, then it'll fix the machine. That doesn't really, things don't really work that way.
Well, there's so much to say there. What the love, medicine, and miracles. Yeah, lots of people have talked about a correlation between intense negative emotions and physical distress. If it's there long enough, it actually becomes physical disease. there's also the idea that we're trained to believe that our thoughts are separate from our emotions, are separate from our body, et cetera. But if you observe children, you realize that's not true at all. When they see something that's new and get excited, there's an emotional intensity that goes right along with the experience of taking in the sights and sounds and smells, et cetera. So it makes really good sense to me that anytime I have an injury, whether it's, you know, a sprained ankle or a broken jaw or whatever, in that moment, I am this energy system that has thoughts and emotions and the spiritual energy and the physical energy, and it's all being affected in that moment. It's not a surprise that even if I'm not consciously aware of an emotion in that moment, there is an emotion that's registered in the system and can be tapped into, as we had an experience, you know, a few days ago, 45 years later.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can think of that energy as frequency. Like you can think of emotion as an energetic frequency. Different emotions have different frequency patterns. I mean, it doesn't matter if you think of it that way or not, but I find it helpful, frankly, because what I see is that we, in our upbringing, we are in an environment that we're given all kinds of messaging. The way I see it is that we're tuned to a certain radio frequency, and we believe that that frequency is the reality. And I guess what this work does is kind of put the tuning dials back in your own hands in a way, and it releases that one station kind of radio into being able to have more range.
Well, and for me, there's also the benefit of practicing awareness at a different level. And, you know, most of the time, I think it was Paramahansa Yogananda who said, there is no such thing as the unconscious. Consciousness is what you've lived through. There's part of it that you're willing to look at and part of it that you're not. And the part you're not willing to look at, we call the unconscious. Well, as I work with someone like you, and I'm, comfortable, confident, trusting, and I'm trusting that, you know, this is going to be safe, then when these things bubble up, because I've just been asked to notice them, rather than shying away or saying, you know, or having the automatic shut off of that's part of my consciousness I don't want to look at, there's more willingness to see what's there. And as I see what's there, as you said, then I've got more access to it. And then I can tune into the frequency differently. I can let it flow through me differently. And my experience of it becomes more conscious and more under my control.
I think so. And I also think that what shifts is the pattern. So what I've noticed in this work, and it's super powerful to be aware of it, is that when we presence ourselves to a sensation, that sensation moves. Whether it's an emotion or a physical sensation, when we can be fully present to it, it's energetic. And when we can allow it without judgment, just being present to it, it dissipates. And I've seen that happen with myself, with pain, with clients, with physical pain, with emotional pain. Like I think in our culture we are taught and conditioned to ignore our emotions, to deny our emotions, to deny physical pain, to tough it through, to, you know, push past it.
Judge them.
To judge, to all of these things that create resistance to the movement of that energy.
And when you say that, it reminds me of Michael Singer, and he was talking about energy. And energy is always in motion. So when we try to stop energy, we label it or we deny it. All we're doing is holding it in place. It's still got to move, so it moves in a circle and it spins. And then other people say, well, then that's when it gets trapped or locked or stuck. And what you're talking about is if I bring my awareness and presence to it without the judgment, you know, without the trying to push it away, it can flow.
Yes.
And then I don't know where it's going to go or what it's going to do, but it's not going to just keep spinning.
Exactly. So that's what I mean by allowing and presence. because in pure presence, I don't believe there's judgment at all, you know. So even in the context of a session, for instance, we might find ourselves observing ourselves and then judging ourselves, and that arising in the course of a session is like, oh, okay, so you're recognizing judgment. Where do you feel that in your body? What does that feel like? And then what's happening is it's peeling off these layers of what I call overlays, overlays on our foundational self, our soul purpose, or what our fundamental being, that are conditioned over the course of our lives, whether through deliberate indoctrination or through experience. And then we develop these patterns. And so the tagline for my work, which I call core connection, is remembering who you really are. And what it's doing is releasing these overlays to create a greater experience of presence and freedom.
And the overlays, as you say that, to me, are the labels, the judgments, the personality traits that I say, oh, well, I'm Irish German. Of course, we do this, we do that. And I lock that in and I don't open it to questioning about, well, there's another.
All of that's true.
There's another rapid transformation therapy. And the man used to say, watch your language. What happens with the tense in your language when you say, oh, I don't do that? What does that mean? That's past tense, present tense, future. What does that mean?
Right. Right.
Well, I don't remember having done that. That's more accurate, right? But when I say, I don't do that, or that's not me, or then I lock in my thought structure, which of course is part of the whole energy system we're talking about, emotions and thought and physiology, and I block a part of it. I literally lock it down with that judgment. And one of the things that was so obvious to me in the work with you is that it was just as fluid and nothing was locked down. It was just, okay, then what? And now what? And this fluid moving through, which helps first identify and then release some of those judgments as you hit them in a session.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking about how when we judge, there's a dynamic that we're creating ourselves as separate from ourselves. And so what's happening, like what you're talking about, is talking about identities. And this is one of the reasons that people feel, this is one of the reasons that I work only with people who have done work, is because this work is about letting go of identities. You know, we can, and that can be very frightening. I've had people show up to sessions saying, I'm scared out of my mind. I don't know what's going to be on the other side of this, because here's who I think I am. And if we're working on that, who am I going to be on the other side? And it's so fascinating, because always who you are on the other side is more of who you really are. It's not like, you know, the fear that comes into the conversation is the fear of not knowing, or the fear of the unknown, you know, and even if, so for instance, people will have a pattern of speaking really poorly to themselves to motivate themselves to do stuff, right? Like if I don't kick myself in the butt, I'm not going to do anything. And because there's an underlying belief that I'm lazy, or I'm not good enough, or something. And in the face of, what if that were to change? What if you didn't do that anymore? There's like, oh my gosh, who would I be? Who would I be without that? I've done that all my life. That's who I am. Right.
And what I talk to people about with that is that I can't be afraid of the unknown unless I've projected something negative into it. Because what if, who would I be? What if I become the most magnificent specimen of this, that, or the other thing ever? Then I get excited about letting go of the old and moving into the new.
Some people get frightened by being the most magnificent specimen too.
Because they're imagining loss and separation from their loved ones, not being able to connect with their family of origin. So I'm always aware that when I have a fear come up, it's false. One of the bottom line observations I have is if I have a negative thought about myself or somebody else that's active in my mind or a negative emotion, I can instantly know three things. The first one is it's a lie or based on a falsehood. Number two is it's an old tape playing. It's not about what's going on in the present moment. And number three, if I take an action from that, I'm just going to make my situation worse. I can't improve my life situation by dumping negative emotions on or acting from the space where the negative emotions would drive my perception and then behavior. So I'm thinking in terms of watching our time, and I want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about, are there other aspects of the work or the way you want to put yourself out there as the therapist that we haven't even mentioned yet?
Well, first of all, I'm going to reject for myself the word therapist because I don't have any of this traditional credentials. Okay, so I won't call myself a therapist. I call myself a transformational coach. The reason that I do that is because people think they know what coaching is, but it is transformational, the work that I do, and it's not limited just to the core connection work. How I would put myself out there is to be someone who is committed to helping people reconnect with their core being and to find their authentic expression in the world. And I have a lot of beliefs and ideas, and I entertain them as hypotheses, not as ultimate truth. But one of those beliefs is that we all came here to do something unique and special, and that we all have a purpose. And that's one of the things that drives me in the work that I do, is to support people in finding their way onto that path if they are not on it, and if they are on it, to support them in fulfilling it to the greatest capacity that they can. And it can be being creating a lovely family. It can be healing relationships with family. It can be doing something that changes the world. It's on whatever full spectrum our purpose can be. It doesn't have to look grand to the outside world, but it can. So, I think that we all came here with a unique song to sing, and that it's that our lives are much happier and fulfilled when we do that, and when we're in alignment with that. And I believe that this is a time in our history as humanity that we need people to be connecting with their soul mission and purpose now more than ever. That if we were all in alignment with that purpose and beingness, that the world would be a much different and a much better place.
Well, and each individual's lives will be more content, fulfilling. You know, it's one of the things that if you talk to a functional medicine practitioner, they'll say, okay, we need food and we need water, we need sleep, but we also need a sense of purpose in life. We need a sense of community and connection to love. And so those things are every bit as valuable as the solid nutrients that we put in our lives in terms of their contribution to a whole life that's enjoyable.
It may be even more important than the solid nutrition. Because that if we're committed to purpose, we may take care of ourselves in a very different way.
Yeah, in a way that just kind of flows from, you know, letting the truth of life act on us rather than have us judging what it should be.
And the thing about the path of purpose, it's not for cowards. It is a hero's journey. It doesn't mean that life becomes instantly easy. It just means that it gives us a sense of meaning, and it gives us resilience that we would not otherwise have, and it gives us a North Star and a context by which we have the ability to rebound from the challenges of life.
And I just flashed on the story of Indra from Joseph Campbell, because you said the hero's journey and there's Joseph Campbell, and the association in my mind is the story of Indra, who was the king of the gods and got overinflated and caused a problem, and then got deflated and caused a problem. And the thing is, just be you and live into what you're supposed to be. So, you know, you may not be the person to send the next rocket up into space, but your existence, your interaction with your family and friends and the people at the checkout stand is an important part of this flow that we call life.
That's another really big foundational part of the work that I do, and that is recognizing our sufficiency, that we are, just by virtue of being, we are worthy. That we don't, our society is so focused and we're so deeply indoctrinated to our worth being tied to what we do or what we own or our achievements, who we know, how much money we have, how many things we have, that is something that we have been taught to associate our value with. And it's just a lie. And as we come back to being able to be present and whole, we then have the ability to shift all the dynamics in the world that are taking us toward destruction. You know, this constant need of more things, more technology, more better, but you know, like more being better. More is not better. More is just more. And I think that this is also a foundation of the work that I do, is as we come back to our own wholeness and our own deep sense of connection and purpose, then things in the world shift, the dynamic of the world shifts. If we're whole and worthy without anything extra that we need to prove ourselves, what would be different?
Everything.
It would.
Yes. Excellent. So how, you know, there'll be, you know, ways people can look you up. One of them is what the website, excuse me, is Core Connection.
YourCoreConnection.com. Now, the thing is, I have a very small practice, deliberately. I work with 10 or 12 people at a time. I have a 3-month cohort. So the next one is starting October 1st, and it'll go October, November, December. Then I take a month off and then another 3-month cohort, theoretically. The way it works is I don't really want my work to be transactional. So what I do is I have a monthly fee, and we schedule a week, a session a week throughout the month. But if people need more than a session in a given week, we schedule additional work. I have a once a week group session for about a half hour where we celebrate our wins, and once a month, one of those sessions is a longer session where I do some kind of process. And so that's how it works. And there's a description of that on my website at yourcoreconnection.com. And I do it that way because, first off, I don't want to do one-off sessions. I really want to see people make massive transformation. And the people that my ideal clients are people that are doing big things in the world. And, you know, that because that gives me a way to multiply the influence, if that makes any sense. So.
Wonderful. Well, I appreciate your sharing with us and being willing to give us another hour of your time. And I look forward to follow up. I'll give you some more feedback on our session from a few days ago. And I'm excited to find out how you train other people to do this. You talked about that multiplier factor. And so I'm framing a goal for you. You don't have to accept it, but I'm framing a goal for you to find a way to train other people to do this powerful work.
So I am really grateful to you for bringing that up, because this is really profoundly powerful work. It's the most powerful work I have found that to be reliably impactful. And that said, I've wanted to train people to do this work so that it wouldn't disappear with me. And I would want people to have an experience of the work in order to be trained into it. And that said, the people that are my clients aren't people that want to be therapists. Therapists in big air quotes again, because of the credential thing. So I am open. I really would like to be able to share this work and have people be able to carry it on. And there are guiding principles for it, for sure. And I've thought for a long time about how I would train it. It's just having the audience to train.
Wonderful. Well, I'm sure the right people will hear this and reach out to you. And I look forward to following up and finding out how that's going.
Thank you so much, Tim.
Well, thanks for the time.
I appreciate this time and what you do in the world and your really, really, really generous commitment to people.
Well, you're entirely welcome and deserving. And I will talk to you again before long with an update about our last session.
Wonderful. Thanks so much.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
I'm sitting here talking and I've got my phone on mute. That's really good. So that was a great interview with Mira Rubin. Thank you, Dr. Tim. And he is not with us today, like I said at the beginning of the show. So Michael and I will begin the second hour here in just a second. Today is Monday, September 27th, 2021. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions, because that makes this your show. So we'll give Michael just a moment to get dialed in. He actually has been doing some errands. And so, hold on. I was letting him know that I was in as host, so he needs to call in on the regular line. And he'll be with us here just momentarily. He did an awesome work with a group last night. It was a private group, so we hadn't announced it to the public to tap into it, but I told him it started at 8 o'clock, and at 10:30 he was finally completing, and I said, you were right on tonight. He was on target. But anyway, I'm not sure if any part of that's going to be available for us to put on the site or not, but we'll let you know, keep you informed on that. It was to a conscious group. And we hope we're all conscious, but I mean, that's part of their name. But anyway, I invite you to go to the website, which is www.whyagain.org. And you can click on the Start Here button. You can scroll down. There is the bullseye in the middle of the page. There's just lots of information. The site's a little bit different than it used to be. So if you haven't been on it in a while, you might have to kind of look around a little bit to find things. If there's something that you would like to see and you have challenge getting to it, then please drop me a line at Jeannie, J-E-A-N-I-E, at whyagain.org, and let me know, and we'll see what we can do. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Honored that you're here once again to play in this conversation about first century Aramaic forgiveness. Realizing more and more and more the depth and the importance of how this process of forgiveness works and the import of it. I'm going to give a shout out to Susan Bingham, and if everybody would hold her and her grandson in the space, he's having some challenges, and so she's working with getting him taken care of with the challenges he's got going on. So, Jacob, we send our love in your direction, and Susan and Tim, we certainly hold you in our hearts and in the space of love so that you have the clarity and the power to do whatever needs to be done to support this young man in entering into a state of full recovery. And this idea that we've talked so often of projection, denial, dissociation, and projection. I've been realizing, actually did a piece of work the other night that opened a new level of understanding for me personally about how that works and how we can energetically access through the energetic links that we have within us those generations who live in pain and trauma and turmoil, or who have lived in pain and trauma and turmoil, and that through our energy fields we can help to remove the pained traumatic energies that are held by those in our bloodline and open the space for those in the future of our bloodline to be freed from the dynamics of anger and rage and guilt and grief and hate and fear and pain and trauma. And that when we live in a state of denial, this state of denial, this game where we think or we speak as though something outside of us is the cause of what's happening inside of us, literally leaves us locked into a place where every painful voice, every painful energy from every generation, you know, people sometimes say, "Well, why are things so bizarre? Why are they so outrageous? Why are they so crazy?" Well, stored within us, literally, this body-mind unit is a device, an energetic device, and as an energetic device, it literally stores every frequency that, and those energetic patterns are stored in every cell in the structure, including the sperm and the egg. So were you to conceive a child tomorrow, that child would have in its structure every thought you've ever thought, every feeling you've ever felt, every reality you've ever engaged in. And when we speak, they made me feel this way. Those energetic patterns, when they are active in ourselves, cause ourselves to output a thing called feelings. And so when we feel a certain way, but we pretend, we instruct our minds to show us that the reason we're feeling this way is because of something going on outside of us, then we literally force our minds to use those implanted, painful thoughts, the thought disorders of a thousand generations, to build a perceptual construct that we call the world, you know, that we think we're looking at through our eyes. And I've said this a few times in the last couple of weeks. It's so important to get. You can't see out through your eyes. You do not have a set of windows that allow you to look out on the world. It's just not a fact. The eye is a one-way valve. Information comes into it in the form of light. That light energy, the information carried on that carrier wave of light energy, causes brain cells to fire. If that light energy that comes in causes brain cells from generations of pained thought disorders, then through resonance, those pained thought disorders start to move in us. If we do not allow them to come up directly to our awareness and learn to work through them, learn to remove them, which is the process of forgiveness, then by denial, we push that energy down and we force our minds to use those energetic patterns to literally create the world that we think we see. Now, thinking that you can see out through your eyes is about as silly as going to your TV set, taking the antenna wire off the back. You remember a time when we had antennas. Taking the antenna wire off the back and looking out through the antenna wire and being able to see what's outside of your house. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It is absolutely as ridiculous to think you can see out through these light receivers called eyes. But, you know, the whole language of the world is, well, everybody sees what's going on out there. You saw that happen, didn't you? No. Information came in through your eyes that resonated brain cells that caused your mind to create a picture of what out of what was resonated by what came into the antenna. And that picture is a generated image that is painted by your mind. I invite you to go to CIA.gov. You'll find a book there called The Study of Human Intelligence. There's a chapter in that book on perception. You know, here the CIA is working with its analysts, attempting to get the best intelligence through their intelligence agents that they can. And read what their research says. I mean, we've been teaching this for decades. Came across this, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. Quote, here's what the CIA says about perception. Here's what the CIA says about the way the mind works. The mind does not record reality. The mind generates reality. So each of us at every moment has what we call a reality being painted in our brains. And rarely does the reality that we're experiencing reflect what actually happened in the actuality. Think about a time, any time that it's ever happened, that someone accused you of saying something you absolutely never said, of doing something you absolutely never did. You ever had that happen? Here's what I guarantee. Go back to any and every time that's ever happened. And what you'll find is the person who is accusing you of something that happened in their reality. Now, they're not lying to you. They're not saying they saw you do it when they did. Well, some people are lying, but generally speaking, they're telling the truth. They saw it. Their evidential mind was told to hallucinate, to generate this reality, and so it did. So generally speaking, when people accuse you like that, they're not lying. They saw it, but they saw it as a picture painted in their mind because that's what's in their mind. That's what their life is about. You might remember in Romans they said, beware you who judge another, for then in which you judge another, you have been guilty of practicing. This is the principle they were talking about. What state of mind were they in? Were they in a state of total connected love and awareness and sweetness? Absolutely not. Never. What state were they in? They were in a state of hostility or fear. And hostility or fear, or any of its variables, is a signal that says the mind is using corrupt data to build its picture world. They saw you do things that didn't happen. They heard words come out of your mouth that you never said. How can that be? Here's how it can be. All you have to do is do a behavior that resonates those brain cells that are linked to hostility and fear, and their reality will reflect the content of their own minds. And they will experience what's in their minds as a picture massaged into looking like you and accuse you of doing what's going on in their brain cells, what they have done. So when you will, any time that your mind is using any form of hostility or fear, if you will start to suspect your own mind, oh, my mind is telling me a lie, then apply the process of forgiveness. And what will happen is, as you forgive, the lies your mind tells you based in corrupt data will collapse in on their own foundation, on their own footprint. And when they collapse in, you will get to access that corrupt data directly. And when, out of a space of connected love, and remember in step four of the worksheet, before you go into the core step of forgiveness, what you do is you reconnect as powerfully as you can with active present love. So when you connect to that presence of love, corrupt data comes forward directly. Now, most people get to see their corrupt data when it's being used by the mind, and they see it indirectly as a picture of someone else. If I say, you made me mad, the brain cells that hold my mad, my corrupt data around my anger, will be used to build my brain's image of you. And you will show up doing exactly what's in my brain cells, because that's how reality is created, out of whatever's firing in brain cells. So when we're experiencing that information indirectly, projecting to our brain's image of others, when that occurs, we do not have direct access to clean up those parts of our mind. The genius of Yeshua coming forward and telling us that what you need to do is collapse your perception, collapse the picture world based in hostility or fear in on itself, and then you have direct access, and in the presence of love, when you access that which is linked to hostility or fear in yourself, it begins to dissolve. Now, you might do, you know, when they said to Yeshua, how many times do we need to forgive? How many darn worksheets do we need to do anyway? They asked, is seven enough? And in Aramaic, his answer was 77 times 70. You may revisit that many times until you clean up the entire mass of corrupt data around any given issue. And that's why we suggest you utilize the forgiveness process repeatedly in areas where your physiology can still produce any form of hostility or fear. Your physiology is not designed to generate perceptions based in hostility or fear. That's not human. That's inhuman. And our world brainwashes us and programs us to think that that state of insanity is normal. So as you cancel goals, which are the drivers for perception, perception collapses in on its own footprint. And when it does, it gives you direct access to that underlying corrupt data. And when that underlying corrupt data comes forward in the presence of active love, its dissolution is automatic. It will begin to disappear. You will be freed from it. Now, if you're not using the forgiveness process, we invite you to go to our website, whyagain.org. And in the upper left-hand corner of the page, you'll see a link that says Start Here. If you click that Start Here link, then you will open a series of links that will walk you through all the steps that you need to understand what forgiveness is and how to apply it. You can download and print the worksheet from the website. You can do the worksheet live on the website. You can go to your app store on your telephone, and you can type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, forgiveness. When you type that in your app store, you'll be looking at the world's first and only forgiveness app. Step by step, here's how it's done. And we are here to support you in learning that and applying it. And I'm going to turn now to the reading of a couple of paragraphs from the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And What You Can Do About It. So we are on, if you're following along with us in the book, we're on page 118. If you don't have a copy of the book and you would like to have a copy, unfortunately, it's out of print. But if you go to eBay or Amazon, there are lots of used books always available on either Amazon or eBay. Just type in, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Or Dr. Michael Rice, R-Y-C-E, and you'll find a copy of the book there. And or you can go to our website, again, whyagain.org. And there's a, you'll see a picture of the book if you click on that and drill down. You'll find the book free to be downloaded in any one of several different languages. And then you can follow along with us. We're talking to Richard about what it takes to turn a child into someone who can hate, to knock the presence of being, the presence of love, so unconscious and brainwash a mind with things like hate that someone can do hate. Our chapter here is on clarifying love. And so I've asked Richard the question, what does it take to take a child there? And he says, I'm not sure if this is what you mean, but I can think back to being a kid, watching the hypocrites fight and belittle each other, and I knew that was not how we were supposed to behave. I kept coming back to my abusers with trust and total love. I can remember that, and I kept getting wiped out. So you took on their behavior, I asked. What? I wouldn't do that, he protested. Are you sure? I questioned. I've never been abused. I've never hit anybody in my life. Have you ever withdrawn love, put down, or tried to control others for your own benefit? Have you used anger, money, or things to manipulate others into behaving the way you want? Have you ever withheld love from yourself? Well, yes, but that's not abuse, he said, looking defensive. Think back to being that kid that kept love present for those who abused him. Excuse me, I had a little cough come up there. So have you ever withdrawn love from yourself? He says, well, yeah, but that's not abuse. Think back to being that kid. You kept love for those that abused you. He only wanted one thing, to be accepted, to be honored, to be cherished. How did he feel when love was withdrawn and he was manipulated with money, threats, and put-downs, I asked quietly, aware that some very tender feelings were surfacing in him. Abused and alone, he replied quietly. I sensed tears just under the surface. Tears had been held inside for a long, long time. Feels to me like there might be a lot of sadness, grief, and uncried tears waiting to let loose, Richard. Well, but I was taught it was wrong to cry. His voice cracked as he tried to hide his sadness. That's another reality with which we've been brainwashed. Macho doesn't work. If we cannot accurately feel our feelings, we're out of touch with an important guidance system. Recall, Richard, the operative principle here is if I'm in pain, my mind is in error. Pain is an attempt on the part of the body to warn you of error and to be of help. Notice you felt abused when all the things you normally do to people, yourself included, were done to you as a child. I pointed out. You mean I'm an abuser? I've never thought of myself that way. I was considered myself a nice guy. I thought what I was doing was normal, he added. These are behaviors that few have escaped. It is an almost universal phenomena, an opportunity for healing that virtually every one of us gets. Unfortunately, abuse and exploitation have become normal for many people. But that does not make it natural. Remember when, as a child, you knew life was about love and abuse was a foreign concept? I believe that the abuse can be inherited, but usually it must be learned. You know, we're starting to step in now to the power person dynamic that we talk about in codependence to interdependence. And you'll remember the power person was a person in your life that had more power over your life at some point than you did. That's factor one that creates a power person dynamic. Factor two is that power person was not functioning as a human being, was not functioning as love. That's factor two. Then number three, if the object of that circumstance perceived the situation as survival, then the power person dynamic was established in the mind of the object of that behavior. Now, usually it's a child, though not always. And when those three things occur, when someone has more power over another's life than they do, is not functioning as love, and that person perceives the circumstance as survival, their energy fields open wide. They're just like a sponge. And every energetic dynamic in the environment, they absorb. They're just like, just suck it all in. And then at any point in the future, when circumstances approximate the circumstance that happened initially with the power person, then the individual who carries around that power person dynamic can do, and I'm talking about for the rest of their lives, they can do only three behaviors. And the behavior they do will be controlled by the level of stress that they're under, and they'll have no choice about it. They'll try to choose differently, but they'll have no choice about it. So the behaviors, once a power person dynamic is installed in the mind, go like this. When there's no stress, a person will do whatever they did to get along with their power person. You know, if they were Mr. Nice Guy, then here they are. Their normal state of being, when not overly stressed, will be Mr. Nice Guy. When stress starts to build, they'll shift out of being Mr. Nice Guy, and they'll become Mr. or Ms. Let's say they'll do whatever they did to resist and survive with their power person. So it might be Mr. Snarky. So all of a sudden, the person that all the time you've known them is Mr. Nice Guy becomes Mr. Snarky, and you're shocked and you're surprised. It's like, well, I've never seen you do that. You're like a different person. Yeah, they call it multiple personality disorder. So under stress, the mind shifts and the automatic decision kicks in and guides people to do what they did to resist and survive with their power person. And then when they become ultra stressed, They'll do whatever their power person did to them that they hated the most. Now, that's under the control of the personal code and the automatic decision system. And when your mind forces you to go into that power person dynamic due to stress, you don't have a choice. I mean, you can choose forever. You can say, oh, I'm going to be loving, I'm going to be loving, I'm going to be loving, I'm going to be loving. And then all of a sudden, the stress hits a certain level and the mind shifts over. And all of a sudden, what dad did was lash out. If dad was power person, what dad did was lash out and hit. Then there will be the inclination to lash out and hit. I can remember doing this, the codependence to independence workshop for an AA group down in Fort Lauderdale several years ago, probably 12, 14 years ago. And there was a man there who'd been in recovery for about 30 years, and he ran a very large online support group for recovery. And when I shared this power person dynamic, he was like almost indignant. It's like, well, that's not the way it works. That's just not how it happens. I said, oh, yes, it is. And he said, well, I can attest that it's not true because my father always abused and hit me. And when my son grew up, I never hit him ever, even once. I said, okay, I got it. So I want to acknowledge you for having enough self-control to keep from hitting your son. But how much time do you still spend trying or refraining from holding back the urge to hit somebody? And I mean, I could have knocked him over with a feather. It was just like, oh my God, every day I want to lash out and hit. Because he had the fortitude to refrain from hitting, that allowed him to believe the power person dynamic didn't apply to him. But here he was 30 years in recovery and still trying to control his fists. This power person dynamic, I would offer, runs the whole world. But when it's running, it's transparent. It's just like Richard, he listed out all the things that he felt he was being abused with, and it was really clear to him that he was being abused. But then when he did the same behaviors, he had a different story for it. Well, you know, I wasn't being abusive. I was just protecting myself. And so, I mean, exactly the same behaviors, but the mind makes them so transparent and so normal looking that we think, oh, well, that's just, you know, that's a normal behavior. Forgiveness allows us to go in and begin to collapse those dynamics in the mind to address the power person dynamic and remove the root of that hostility or fear. And that's the whole purpose of the process of forgiveness. And that is exactly what we are here to bring forward on a global scale and make available to every mind, heart, and being on the planet. If you're interested in learning more about and doing some serious work around the power person dynamic, and I'd offer it runs the whole world. I mean, there isn't a person on the planet that doesn't need to do work on this power person dynamic. So if you're ready to jump in and do something with that, we have an online self-study intensive package that includes 90 hours of video that covers the whole topic of codependence, communication, healing through relationships, forgiveness, mind shifter, still point breathing. There's a whole series of workshops that are included in this 90-hour self-study program. We cover each of those workshops, and then there are discussions, there are questions and answers. We take you through, in that 90 hours, two different still point breathing processes. There are question and answer sessions. I mean, the whole topic is covered in depth and thoroughly. And so if you're interested in that package, It's something that can be purchased on our website, or you can drop Jeannie a note or myself a note, and we'll get you set up for it. The cost of the whole 90-hour video program is $600. It includes two personal code evaluations where we'll walk you through the personal code evaluation process and give you feedback on where your blockages are. You know, you just heard how Richard, how transparent his mind was, and how, well, no, that's just normal. There's nothing wrong with that. And then when he really looks, it's like, oh, my God, that's exactly what was done to me that was so terrible. When we do it, we tell our minds tell us a different story. It doesn't say, oh, well, when you withheld love, you were abusing them just like dad or mom did when you were a kid. It says, oh, the mind tells us, oh, well, you know, they don't deserve your love right now. They're pushing your love away. Therefore, you should withhold it. And all of a sudden, it looks different. So there are many tools within the codependence to interdependence communication practicum that will walk you through healing these parts of the mind. The program also includes the full access to the Facebook page and the Trello app that has 14 days of fresh and raw recipes and all of the instructions for
Michael,
how to begin to operate. Yes, sweetie?
It's actually 14 weeks. She did 14 weeks of menus and recipes.
Oh, right. Correct, yes. 3 days a week, 14 weeks. Thank you, sweetie, for catching that.
7 days a week. 7 days a week for 14 weeks.
For 14 weeks, right.
Yep. All 7 days a week.
Three meals a day. And she explains what equipment's needed to do the fresh and raw food. If you want to shift out of, you know, the SAD diet, the standard American diet that guarantees death and degeneration, then this is a powerful program. And, of course, different people use it at different levels. Some people just kind of dance around the edge of it. Some go whole hog. And some start slowly and build up. So there's a layout of what equipment is needed for your kitchen, where to buy it at the best prices. There are videos and audios of the menus, when to order, you know, for week one, week two, week three, week four, when to order, what to order, and in order to do those menus. So it's all laid out. It's a really beautiful program that Yurate has done. And then the Trello app, you can we'll give you access, password and such, so that you can get on the Trello app, and you can access those recipes. Got color pictures, videos, explanations, so an ongoing program there for anyone who wants to some support for shifting their eating habits. And so all of that's included in that package at $600, and that's 90 hours self-paced self-study. And, of course, we're here with the radio show 5 days a week to support you if you're doing that program with questions. And so that's all part and parcel of that codependence to interdependence communication intensive. And beyond that, Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
Nobody has their hand up, but it seems like we were having a conversation with Dusty or someone on Friday. Oh, his hand just went up. So good.
Oh,
hi,
sweet.
Dusty. Welcome.
Well, yes. Hi, Jeannie. Hi, Michael. Good.
Hey there, young man. Welcome.
Everybody. And I like what you just read. And I think that, and having spent time, a little time in the 12-step program, just because, 2-3 years, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
At any rate, last Friday we were talking about, and you mentioned you'd like to kind of continue it. I think the last word that we used was intention.
Intention, correct, yeah.
Right, and I was talking about, for those who weren't there then, I'll just do a brief synopsis of it now. When I was 5 years old,
right,
I came out of the house. I was putting on my jacket. I mean, I remember it. I'm in it right now, as I'm telling you.
That's
fresh in my
awesome.
Mind. Present. Came over me, that was very powerful. And all of a sudden I went, oh, I have a motto. And it was, don't hurt anybody or anything. And at that moment, I became this like wise elder. And I mean, it was very, very powerful. And that stuck with me my whole life. And that's been part of my code, Ahimsa, Hippocratic Oath, et cetera. And what a gift that was, however, whatever it means. And so, and then I think you mentioned something from there and we were rolling on. But I told that.
Right. Yeah, my take, Dusty, at that point would be that that was one of those awakening moments where what the ancients would call the mind of Christ in you awakened and spoke to you. And, you know, when that happens, I mean, it guides. I mean, it's the peak experience of a whole lifetime.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. I mean, that's very beautifully put. I've never heard it quite as lovely as that. And, yes, it was. It was.
And the whole objective of this.
Go ahead.
You go ahead.
I was just going to say, at the time, I mean, even at five, I felt like this kind of wise elder for a while, but I was also 5 years old, but I kind of had a sense of other beings around me in that moment that were all part of this ahimsa, part of this non-harmfulness. And it just
right. Only
took them a few seconds or whatever, but that was it. It was done.
Yes.
And I've been that way my whole life.
Yeah, powerful moment of awakening. That's awesome.
Yeah. And
the whole objective of this work is to go there. Is that's where we're designed to live. The whole objective is to purposely, consciously awaken to that state and to live out of that mind.
Yo, boy, I wish I could do that all the time. You know what I mean? Consciously. But I don't hurt. I will not hurt. I will not cause harm. I'm rambunctious as hell. I'm impatient. I've got all the usual, you know, warts and flaws of anybody, but by God, I will not deliberately cause harm in any way. And what I really need to do is remember to apply that to me.
Yeah. Kings hate people like that.
Well, it's kind of a free thinker's concept. I mean, you're not part of the drone mass if you're really operating from that place.
Right. But kings want people who will, on command, go to war and kill and steal other people's property and, you know, do all sorts of things that that one who lives in an awakened state. And that's one of the reasons why I think the systems are set up in the world to purposely drive people into unconsciousness and make sure they never wake up to that state.
Yes. And all you have to do is just go look, hang out with your computer for a little while or the TV or just walk down the street. It's interesting to me how many places I have lived where if somebody walks down the street with a dog and the other person has a dog and, oh, everybody's best friends for a while and they sit around and talk doggies a bit. And I'm not knocking having a dog, but if you don't have a dog, you don't exist. It's funny. I've noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk by and say hi, and they may not even acknowledge the hi, but if I had a dog, they would. And I go, and I think that's a symptom. I mean, I'm saying, well, there's a lot of love in a dog, and I understand that in many cases it's just really healing and beautiful and everybody wins. But other cases it seems very, I don't know, it just doesn't seem right to me. It just seems a bit obsessive or they're not dealing with whatever. Because they've got the dog. I've just noticed this so much that it can't be a coincidence. It's just like 90, 8% like that I've noticed.
Hmm.
And I don't know where I'm going with this, but except this part of the culture. I mean, to me, I see that as part of what the kings have driven some people to do. You can have a healthy relationship with anything, or it can be neurotic, a diversion.
Right. Well, the place that I wanted to go on Friday with the intentions, we'll send you a schematic of the mind that we use in our Laws of Living course. And the frontal lobes of the brain are the place where intentions are stored. The back of the brain is a place where perception is stored. The two interact to produce the world of perception. And the way they interact is that intentions are ultimately the raw material of goals. Can drive perception and cause behavior. Intentions can't. That's why the ancients said the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right. You know, I hear what you're saying. A goal, right, is the intention, secondary
so
goal.
The intentions are the raw material that are turned into goals, and the quality of our intentions are really important. You've heard me talk before about when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? If you want to be a human being, what's the key? What's most important? And he doesn't say love God, love neighbor as yourself, as the Greeks tell us he says. In Aramaic, what he says there is have rachma for the creator, for your neighbor, which in Aramaic means anybody that you think about. And by so doing, you maintain self. And rachma is a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain over intentions. There are three different qualities of intentions, the same way as there are three different qualities of perceptual content in the mind. There are intentions that are key to love. There are intentions that are negative. There are intentions that are destructive. Which filter is active determines the available pool that you have of intentions. If rachma is active, then the only intentions that can come to awareness, that can pass through those frontal lobes of the brain, are those that are keyed to love. If hostility is active, then the quality of intentions that will pass through, and only one filter can be active at a time, are destructive. If fear is active, then the only quality of intentions that can pass through those frontal lobes of the brain to become the raw material or goals are those which are destructive. So the quality of our intentions is so important, and once you keyed in, once that presence spoke to you, it sounds like that was like your gateway for rachma to be active in your life. And so now when intentions come forward, I select from those available intentions a goal, something that I want to achieve. When it's at the intention phase, it can't drive behavior. It's a saying, you know, that we have in Laws of Living is that an intention can no more cause a behavior than a shadow can carry a stone. So once I have a quality of intention, I turn it into a goal, then that goal is going to activate or pass through one of three filters over perception. And depending on which filter is set, there are three different qualities of perception. If hostility is the active filter over the perceptual mind, then it doesn't matter who somebody looks at. No matter how much I say I cherish that person, if hostility is active, I'm going to be irritated, and I'll think my irritation is about them. Because when the hostility filter is active, the only brain cells that can be used to build our perceptual guidance are those that are keyed to hostility. and that is irritation. If fear is active, I mean, we've all heard about, and it's so ridiculous when you think about it, we've heard about the 6'2" father who cherishes their child so deeply, their newborn, and the newborn's just 3 months of age, and this father shakes the baby to death. How can that possibly happen? If hostility was active, then that 6'2", 280-pound guy looked at this 12-pound baby and perceived them as a threat. Or if the fear filter is active, when the hostility filter is active, it's irritation. When there's a corollary filter to rachma over intentions, and I'll send you a schematic of it, the corollary filter over perception in Aramaic is kuba. Those two filters active together were in Aramaic called perfect love. And you remember they said perfect love casts out fear. The mind can't build a fear-based perception or cause a fear-based behavior if these two filters are set. And the perceptual construct will be one of love. And we've all heard about a good example of it. We've all heard about the woman who was horribly abused and you know, afraid for her life. And, you know, we went and we helped her and we got her into a woman's shelter. And she was safe. And 2 weeks later, what did she say?
I know.
I love him. I want to go back. It's like, wait a minute, he almost killed you. Oh, yeah, but, you know, now that fear filter has quieted down, her mind no longer generates a perceptual construct of him as threatening, but love has become active again. Kuba has become active, and all she can remember is, oh, I love him. So she went back. It didn't take very long till that fear filter was active again. And then something else happened. She got really peeved. The hostility filter kicked in. When the hostility filter kicked in, she no longer saw something loving about him. She no longer saw something that would from the fear filter where she would feel threatened. But boy, her hostility filter was active, and she is irritated, and I don't care how big he is, she'll take him apart. That's those three different filters active and the three different perceptions that the mind creates about any given object of attention. But the key way, the main key is, if rachma is active, that's where you keep the whole system on track with love. And that's...
Right.
To me, sounds like exactly what happened to you at 5 when that presence appeared and that filter activated. There you were. You were keyed into it. Does that make sense for you?
That makes sense to me, and I really like the correlation that you've given between intention and goal. And because when I meditate with a lot of intention, but when I think about it, it's really tied hand in hand, hands with a goal, you know what I mean? So I never thought of it that way quite, but I appreciate that. I wanted to bring up one point, and I don't know how you feel about this. But
go for it.
My perception. People really rock the old... environmental influences, you know, I mean, and it should be, you know, the psychologist, et cetera, it's all about, mostly about environment, and some of it's about genetics, how people turn out, but I submit to you and the listeners that there's a third factor that's probably bigger than both. Certainly as big, and that's the quality of the soul that's incarnated, that's having it. Because, you know how it is. You can get identical twins, like two girls that look the same, of the same age, they got the same, you know, genetics, environment, and everything, and one turns out great, and the other one, like, goes right off the cliff kind of thing.
Right.
It's that soul that comes in, and is there a word in Aramaic that kind of covers the concept of soul?
Yes, it's the word is nafsha.
Say that again, please.
Nafsha is the being. So you hear this story about creation, and you know, I've heard people say that Moses must have been getting kind of senile when he told this story, because he talks about the creation of man. And, you know, the starting point is, it says, in the image and likeness of God, he created them, male and female, he created them, and they stop. There's no mention of dust or dirt or earth or Adamos, which means the red clay. So there's that creation story, and the creation of humans is finished. That's nafsha. The word that's used in that passage in Aramaic is nafsha. And then it starts over and it says, there was no man to till the soil. Like, people think Moses was getting senile and forgot that he'd already told about the creation of man. But he was talking about the creation of beings. And then, no man to till the soil meant there was no physical component yet. And then Adamos, which means the red clay, is introduced, dust to dust. And so now we have physiology being formed. And once it's formed, then what it says is, and God breathed into Adamo's nostrils nafsha, the breath of life, and nafsha became an incarnated or a living spiritual being. So it's kind of like that's the point at which the being that we're created as meets with the body-mind unit and the multi-generational database that's contained within this carbon-based memory system.
How do you spell nafsha? I'm curious.
N-A-P-H-S-H-A. Nafsha.
I wanted to... God dang it. Hold on. N-A-P-H.
S-H-A.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
S-H-A. Nafsha. Oh, N-A-P-H-S-H-A.
Okay.
And so if we're awake in our nafsha, if nafsha is awake, and that would be what I would hear you describing as at five, you have the recollection of waking up to that state of being. You know, being can't do harm. The created essence and presence of love can't do harm. But carbon-based memory filled with all kinds of craziness can do any sort of insanity that goes.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I agree with you that state of being and how awake one is really a big key. And, you know, let's imagine we've got that set of twins being born and, you know, mom and dad were so, you know, excited about having a baby, you know, had great prenatal care. The doctor took care of her and everything was wonderful. And the day comes to have the baby and they end up, you know, they go to the hospital instead of doing it at home. Much more dangerous place to have a baby than at home, but that's not what the medical community will tell us. But they go to the hospital and, you know, the doctor's getting ready and she's excited and he's excited and the doctor's excited. And there is an environment, an energetic environment that baby comes into. They've shown that a child, they can take somebody at 40, 50, 60 years of age, put them in hypnosis. They can go back to the moment of their birth and tell who was in the room. They can tell what everybody in the room was feeling. They can even tell what hairdo mom had. And they've been able to verify that. So let's imagine this child is being born. Everybody's excited. The environment is just awesome for the child to come into. And because carbon-based memory, this multi-generational database, operates by the law of resonance, the energy that resonates in this child as they're getting ready to come out of the womb is, this is going to be a good life. Mom's happy. Dad's happy. The house is prepared. Everything is awesome and wonderful, and the doctor's even excited for them. This is going to be an exciting life, and that's what resonates within that child, and they come in, and that becomes the foundation for their lives. But let's imagine as that birth is taking place, the doctor takes a stethoscope and checks, and he hears a second heartbeat. Oh, my God, I missed it. They're going to be twins. And as the first baby is being born, and it's just been born, he turns to the father and says, there's a second baby. Now, he's in terror because his liability insurance is already through the roof as an OBGYN. And he says to Dad, Dad, there's a second baby. And Dad is like, what? Wait a minute. We're not prepared for that. We've only got one extra room in the house. That's the baby's room. We can't afford another baby. You've got to be kidding. So now, doctor's in terror, Dad's in fear and disturbance, and then Mom is informed, and she's like, "Oh my God, a second baby! I don't know if I can handle that." Geez, you know. I was working with a nurse midwife, and she was telling me how sometimes it's so difficult to breastfeed, and I want to breastfeed my baby, and I've heard how painful it can. I'm going to have to do two of them. You got it? No, we can't. We can't. What resonates in that child's multi-generational database, and what becomes the foundation of the life he's going to live? Not going to be so happy. And those two kids are going to have such totally and completely different lives just based on that 1 2-minute experience, let alone everything else that happens in the life to change and shift energetic patterns and where we're going to go. So, there are a lot of factors.
Yeah, that part that you mentioned, that people can actually – in hypnosis or whatever, and it's been duplicated, some actually kind of remember that first moment, the moment.
Yes.
In some way. You know, I think they're mostly impressions that probably later get refined. And I've had that happen to me, and I can tell you my my mother was a medical woman, and she bought into all that. So I was a C-section. She was knocked out. My sense of it, and only God knows whether I've got this right or not, but my sense of it was I'm floating around in this beautiful fluid, and next thing I know, I'm jerked out 3 days early. I'm not ready to even go down the tubes yet. And chop!
Temperature drops 25 degrees.
Yeah, and the umbilical cord gets chopped off, and there's bright lights everywhere. The lights are just unbelievably bright.
And, deprivation of oxygen.
It was just you know, it's beyond description how what a rude shock that was.
Yeah, well, you think about, you know, if you're a runner, people get a stitch in their side from running. What's the stitch that people get from running? Well, it's actually, if someone's breathing really deeply, it's opening parts of the lungs that haven't been opened before, and it's actually a burning sensation. So you think about the child that's in utero with all of its oxygen needs, all of its nutritional needs met, it's comfortable, it's warm, and all of a sudden, I mean, when a child is born, cutting that cord is about one of the most insane things you can do. It's designed to keep supplying oxygen so that the child can gently open their lungs. But when they cut it off prematurely, the child has to go, and what happens? It's like one giant stitch in the lungs. No wonder babies cry. Like, why do we want babies to cry at birth? Neither of my children cried at their home births because the environment was not one that there was a bright operating room light and a cold, icy room that dropped the temperature instantly by 25 or 30 degrees.
Right.
And the medical model of fear and intensity, but a warm, gentle, loving environment where the temperature was similar to the womb. The cord was left to supply oxygen to the body so the lungs could gently open. And there's no need for a burning in the lungs or a cry.
Well, that's beautiful, yeah. Yeah. Well, I have to admit that to this day, almost every day, I will go down to the ocean, put on fins, and go out for an hour, catching waves, working out, going under the water, doing some mojo, you know, just that sort of thing. And I've always realized that it's like the womb. And I thought back about how I wonder how much of that is tied with, you know, my birth. And at the same time, for a variety of reasons, I steady breath and I really, I do a lot of different kinds of breathing. And
right.
It helped me fly because, you know, I'm not a, by most people's standards, I'm not a spring chicken anymore. And, but regardless, the breath has always been a big deal to me. And I have learned how to do all kinds of things correctly, and it really helps. But it is interesting that I don't know how much of that is a connection with that birth that was interrupted. I'm floating around in the fluids, and the next moment I'm not. I don't know for sure, but I suspect there's some kind of connection.
It's, you know, physiology is designed to learn more. You know, the whole stress of birth has a purpose, and it prepares physiology and the mind to learn more in the first minutes of birth than it will learn in any other short period of time in their lives, that person's life.
Right. And, you know, the way you just described a minute ago, I mean, and I've known midwives, I've lived in the same house as midwives and blah, 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 and kind of been around some of that, but you described it and it kind of touched me, that part about if the baby comes into a loving home environment and the umbilical cord's allowed to stay until its job is done kind of thing, and there's all that stuff, in comparison to somebody that went through something like I did, and there's quite a few people that were subjected to that sort of thing in those days. Wow, that's really beautiful, that the way you described the home birth. And just allowing things to kind of have that umbilical cord still there. Oh, for a while. I love that.
Yeah, it's like it's so obvious. What's the rush? Except, you know, maybe the doctor's got a golf game, but...
Yeah. See, that's a big factor. Yeah, it's like
for sure.
Scheduling. Unfortunately,
it's a big factor in a lot of C-sections too.
Well, that's yeah, and that's the problem. There's some things where it doesn't matter so much. You got a little bit of time one way or the other, but a C-section, I don't know, to pull a child out prematurely, my sense of it was 3 days, but who knows, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't time yet. And there was nothing
right.
within me had any sense of all of a sudden, oh, boom, time. No. My mom, who was an incredibly educated woman, ran a county hospital lab and x-ray department. So she was completely inoculated into this whole, you know, the medical paradigm of the time.
And right.
To her, this, oh, I didn't want to go through all that pain, you know. I'm pretty sure there was a doctor scheduling involved in this. Somebody wasn't thinking.
Yeah, there's some crazy stuff that goes on.
Yeah.
And we watched a while back on Netflix, or it's an ongoing program that they have. It's called Call the Midwife. And in each show, it's really a powerful series, but in each show they do one or two or three or four births. And I would always just cringe at, you know, the baby would be born, and immediately they'd go cut the cord. It's like, what are you doing? That's just so ridiculous. But it's standard of care, so you can't hold anybody accountable for that now.
I wonder if you or Jeannie have a sense, and I realize it would probably differ a little bit, but if a baby like is born at home and it comes out, is there a length of time typically, approximately, that umbilical cord stays intact?
Well, basically what you do is you wait till it starts pulsing. The mother's body knows when to stop sending blood to the child. There's a signaling system. And so the cord will turn white and it stops pulsing, and that's when you cut the cord. You leave it connected until the process is finished.
Yeah, and 10,000 years ago, that's what they did.
Yeah, and I don't know over time, you know, just what the, you know, what the range would be. I would think anywhere from maybe 15 to 20 minutes, maybe to an hour. I don't know. I really don't remember. You know, my kids were 40 years ago, and so I really don't remember just how long. That was not the most important thing on my mind, but I do remember that we waited until the cord stopped pulsing to cut it.
Oh, that answers it even better. Ask the question. I mean, that's the definitive way to do that. And I think I kind of had knew that at one time and had forgotten it. Thank you. Yeah. It's important.
Yep. I think it's urgent. Well, we've covered a lot of territory. Any other thoughts on your mind for today, sir?
No, I mean, I can rehash a little bit of what we talked about last week, but no, I'm good. And since there may be somebody else with their hand up, I don't want to take their time. But I appreciate it. And thank you, Jeannie, and both of you. And I will talk to you later, I guess.
All right, blessings. Delight to have a conversation with you, Dusty. Thank you for the call.
Okay.
Namaste. Well, Miss Jeannie, we're down to about 6 or 7 minutes, thereabouts.
Yeah.
Do we have anybody else out there? Do you have any thoughts to add, anything to share?
The only other thing I thought of was, you know, you talked about a child being able to say what the room was like when they were born. And I've shared this in the past that, you know, Ryan, I was 4 months pregnant and he was a twin and I lost the girl and was, you know, bedfast for the rest of the pregnancy. And so Ryan's my survivor. And he remembers having the sister. And for the first many years of his life, he always had to have a girlfriend. But I mean, even in, we're talking kindergarten, first grade, because he needed that female attachment that he was missing. And we did have a hand just now go up.
Great. Let's say hello.
Area code 904, you're on the air.
Hey there, 904. Give us a name. Where are you calling from? You are connected. Are you with us, 904? Your hand went up, and you're connected. Are you mute challenged, 904?
They actually just disappeared, so they must have been having trouble on their end.
Yeah, it must have been, yeah. Well, I remember that when you talked to Ryan about that, and he replied that he had always known that it was his sister. And it's so true. You know, I got to meet Ryan first when he was about let's see, what, we've been 12 or 13, and
he was,
Ryan didn't go, didn't go 2 minutes without a girlfriend. There was always a girl in his life. If he broke up with a girlfriend, I mean, it was 2 minutes and he had another girlfriend. And he and his wife just have a wonderful relationship, you know, once they connected and decided to marry, and they've been together, what, I don't know, 13 years now, something like that. They're just coming up on their anniversary.
they started dating in August, the same year we got married, so 2005. And then they got married in 2010.
Right. Yeah, that was interesting. They decided when they were dating to get a dog, and you know, it'd be at our house 3 or 4 days. It'd be at Ryan's or Gabby's house for 3 or 4 days, back and forth. And you know, dogs can only hold their urine for so long, so somebody'd have to get up in the middle of the night. It was always one of the when they did get up to take the dog out, they'd call the other one and wake them up in the middle of the night. They'd have a conversation while the one, either Gabby or Ryan, were out walking the dog. And it was sweet to watch how they did that, and it was kind of like they learned to co-parent a dog at that point. It was good practice for the awesome parents and the awesome way they care for our granddaughter, Ari Rain. It's just fabulous to watch them. It's pretty cool, pretty sweet. So we're down to the last couple of minutes. We appreciate everybody being with us. And, you know, if there's a particular conversation on the show that you're really touched by, remember that at the end of the show, you can always go to our website, whyagain.org, and there's a picture of a microphone. If you click the microphone and you just keep following links, drill down, you'll come to the archives. And so, you know, shortly after, I'm not sure exactly how long it takes, but within minutes of the show being complete, you can go to the archive and download an MP3 of it, or you can create a link to it that then you can send to somebody. You know, if there's somebody you think will be touched by a particular show, then pass it along to them. And I know that you know, a couple of people over the years have shared with me that when there are important things that happen on the show for them, they've actually edited that part of the show out and saved it and listened to it over and over and over again. So there are lots of ways to use this material, and we appreciate the fact that you're here lending your ears and passing the work on to others. And we hold a space for you to have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's a really awesome gift to give the world. Each of us is capable of giving this gift, and the world is in desperate need of it. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.